The background to the readings this morning, that Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" After some discussion, Peter declared, "You're the Christ." Jesus then told them he was heading towards Jerusalem, where the religious leaders would have him executed, but that he would rise again. Peter confronted Jesus over this, but was firmly put in place. So the reading from Luke chapter 9, verses 28 to 36. About 8 days after Jesus said this, he took Peter, John, and James with him, and they went up onto a mountain to pray. And as he was praying, the appearance of his face changed, and his clothes became as bright as a flash of lightning. Two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared in glorious splendor, talking with Jesus. They spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Peter and his companions were very sleepy, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. As the men were leaving Jesus, Peter said to him, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He didn't know what he was saying. While he was speaking, a cloud appeared and covered them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. A voice came from the cloud saying, "This is my Son, whom I have chosen. Listen to him." When the voice had spoken, they found that Jesus was alone. The disciples kept this to themselves and did not tell anyone at that time what they'd seen. Following on from that, in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, it says, "Therefore, since we have such a hope, we are very bold. We're not like Moses, who would put a veil over his face to prevent the Israelites from seeing the end of what was passing away. But their minds were made dull. For to this day, the same veil remains when the old covenant is read. It has not been removed, because only in Christ is it taken away. Even to this day, when Moses is read, a veil covers their hearts. But whenever anyone turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And we all, who with unveiled faces contemplate the Lord's glory, are being transformed into his image with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. Therefore, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart. Rather, we have renounced secret and shameful ways. We do not use deception, nor do we distort the word of God. On the contrary, by setting forth the truth plainly, we commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God." Thanks be to God.
Passage we've just heard read. There have been various attempts to try and capture images in understanding what's going on there. And to be quite honest with you, I don't really understand it. And it's one of those I said earlier on, where when you're reading through the Gospels or you hear the passage being read in church and you look at it and you think, it's one of those weird ones. It's one of those, I can understand the healings, I can understand the feeding of the 5,000 and other gospel stories. I struggle with something like this. It reminds me of my feelings looking at something like Revelation and the weird elements that come into that, or some of the passages in Daniel where you have descriptions of beasts and lives and hosts and all the rest of these things happen. And this is touching on that. Which is where the whole point of the idea of the word exegesis came into my head. Of, I'm bringing my preconceptions of this as a strange story, and I'm putting it on there, and as a result, I push the whole thing to one side. And it's been very interesting to have that highlighted and to see, is there a way of moving forward from that and gaining an understanding that's been missing? Partly because if you're going to say it's a weird one, it puts a question into your head as to, it doesn't matter quite so much. It's not so important. It's odd. I'll look at the bits that I like. The Bible's thick enough. There's plenty of other bits to read. And I can focus on those instead, and I can possibly, I'm almost putting the question onto that passage as saying it doesn't matter quite so much. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. I don't honestly know. There's all sorts of consequences. If you start asking questions as to which bits of the Bible are true and not, you then go down all sorts of rabbit holes. What do you mean by truth? What do you mean by the real stuff? Do you mean scientific truth? Do you mean all those kind of evidence-based discussions? Do you mean something more vague? And I don't know that you can do that on the Bible, so we're building up to this point here. You can look at other stories in the Bible. I'm not sure whether you can see it from back there. This is the story of the Good Samaritan, the first part of it, guy gets beaten up. And the second part. There's a whole lot of Lego have been animated into beautiful pictures. If you ever work it, it's fantastic. There's so much stuff out there. But we know that's not true. We know that that was a story that Jesus told. And yet, when we don't ask the question as to whether it's true or not, we still get understanding and knowledge and wisdom from that. It is worth reading. We don't dismiss it simply because it's a story. We stick to it. We learn from it. It has value. It has meaning. A story. We'll come back to this in a minute, but we want to ask the question, is it true? Is it not? Does it matter? Is it real? We'll look at that in a minute. But the idea that the parables have a value and an understanding, and we'll come to this point in a minute. And I know I said I was worried before about people quoting individual verses, but this from Timothy is, stay away from foolish arguments because you know they grow into quarrels, and I couldn't think of a better one to discuss what's going on at the moment until I read at the beginning of the top of the notices here, the thought for the week. Without looking, can anybody tell me what it is? Sorry? Exactly. Thank you, thank you. Yes, yes, I had to double check. Yes, God's best intent is often found in life's worst moments. Thank you, Kate. That is absolutely right. And what an interesting way of looking at the world right now, given that the way we're going through all sorts of interesting things. And I'm not going to... I don't... Anyway, we'll come back to that in a minute. What we're looking for is allowing the words, whether it's in the Gospels or whether it's in a strange story, to give us some understanding, that we can become more appreciative of what God's trying to say. We can get the message. We can do the things. We can understand better of what's coming out of that. Now, this matters because this story that we're going to come back to now, it does appear in the Bible. So, therefore, whoever wrote it, in this case Luke, wanted to say something with it. He had a message he wanted to deliver. The idea that a picture says 1,000 words. He is painting a beautiful picture in here that says this. And I want you as a reader to know it. I want you to understand it, and I want the message to come through. More than that, it also appears in Mark and it also appears in Matthew. So 3 highly respected biblical teachers thought it was a valuable image, thought it was precious, thought it matters. Therefore, we should make it serious. We should take it seriously. And not only did this passage include there, where they went up the mountain with the three disciples and Jesus and the transfiguration and the whole point happened and just a moment. But the background to it that might sort of summarise there briefly, the idea that Jesus asked his people, his followers, who do other people say I am? And they gave a few answers. Who do you say that I am? And Peter came out with the answer. And it moves forward. And it's all part of that because the Gospels include the whole section in its entirety multiplied over three times. Which, when you think of the book of Mark, Mark's only 16 chapters long. And this, it falls over a chapter division, but it is essentially a whole chapter's worth. A 16th of his entire book is given over to this. He felt this image, this metaphor, this description of Jesus, this whole understanding of who Jesus is, was more important to include than the nativity story, which does not appear in Mark. It jumps straight in at the beginning of Jesus' teaching. But this passage was included, and it matters. No, I forget what comes next. Ah. In the days that they were writing, there was an understanding of how you became a rabbi. Of how a young man, virtually always men, although now it's one of the most mixed, there are women rabbis in the Jewish faith, would follow another teacher for 2, 3, 4 years, a period of time. And at some point, the senior rabbi would be aware that the novice has got it. He's understood. He's got a comprehension. He's learned the Bible. He's learned the teachings. He's learned the scriptures. He's got an understanding of what the meaning is. And he is now ready to be a rabbi in his own right. And there would be a ceremony. There would be a moment, a laying on of hands. The blessing would pass from the senior to the novice. But it wouldn't just be one. It would be two. At least two rabbis, and they both had to be confident that this novice would go forward in the best traditions and be a respected, honourable person. They were putting their name to this character. They were saying, in our authority, in our wisdom, in our respect, our reputation is also on this person. And that was just how things worked, and people knew that. There wasn't a rabbi degree, there wasn't a scholarship, there wasn't a PhD, there wasn't the probably a scroll or something, I would imagine, but it would carry it, and that's how it would function. So in this story, we have Jesus, and we have Elijah, and we have Moses, and they're with him, they're talking with him, they are discussing with him. Right at the beginning of Mark's Gospel and the other part of Gospels as well, there is the idea of Jesus' baptism. When Jesus comes out of the water, he is blessed by John as a man and a prophet, and he is blessed by God. The voice from heaven comes down, "This is my Son with whom I am pleased." That moment there is the blessing that says, this man, Jesus, is blessed from both sides. Two rabbis, two leadership, two authority figures, two reputations are coming on Jesus. And here, in the image that we've shown just now, you have Moses and you have Elijah, and they are both saying, Jesus. Now, Elijah. Don't know if that's the clearest of images. I'm sure there are churches with stained glass windows where we could point to one and say, this is the story of Elijah. Elijah was the prophet. Elijah was the prophet. In the Old Testament, he was a figure of character and devotion. He was around whom the Hebrew nation saw Elijah as a very established, mattered. He was important. There were other prophets, Amos and Hosea and Isaiah and everybody else as well. But they traced their roots back to the teachings of Elijah. Then you have Moses. I couldn't find a picture of Moses. This is taken from a film set, from a cover of a book, a cover of a film rather that was produced, and it's called Moses the Lawgiver. Moses the Lawgiver. Moses the film star, Moses the powerful figure, Moses the one who went up the mountain to get the law engraved on stone from God's own hand and bring that to his people. So you have Jesus, Elijah, Moses, in all their fire in just at that moment. And the interesting thing that if a rabbi was and the novice presumably would be subservient at that point, would be blessed, would have his hands, would have the rabbis, the senior figures would lay their hands upon him and bless him, and he would go out into the world. In this situation, Elijah, they were equal. They were talking. They were communicating. They were on the same level. Moses, the figure who brought them out of Egypt, and all the things that he did there, and is such a historical and legendary figure within the Jewish history. And Elijah, the reputation, the solidity, the teachings that stem from him. And Jesus in the middle, an equal part to that. And especially with the background beforehand, where Jesus says, who do people say that I am? Other people say, you're precious, you're special, you're wonderful, you're a prophet born back to life, you're a teacher, you're wise. Peter says, you're the Son of God, you are the Messiah. Moses says, you're on the same level as me. You have come to fulfill the law, as Jesus says in a different point. Elijah says, of all the prophets that we have, you are my equal. You are the same. I might be held in high esteem by the Jewish nation, and you're my level. And then the voice from heaven came down, and God said this. So not only is Jesus, all of these people, whether it's from the ordinary people to the disciples, to the prophets, to the law, to God himself, it points to Jesus, 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 Jesus. We look at that figure all the time. And what teaching comes out of that? What things matter? Which is why we then study the rest. And I think that's probably why all three of those Gospels included this, because it is an understanding of this image that then shapes how we understand every other element of the Gospels, all the other teachings that Jesus, where Jesus does things and says things, and the challenges that he throws out to the authority figures, and the support that he gives to those who are oppressed. All of that stems from what? I'm not sure where to go with this. No, I am. I know what I want to say, but we're going to go with something here. There's a question about that whole situation. Let me get rid of that. It was interesting when I put the figure up, I noticed one or two people responded to it. It's a very interesting idea to that. Is it true? Is it not? Does it matter? Does it not? We're going through, in this world at the moment, we're going through a difficult situation. And the reason it's difficult, well, one of the reasons is, it was a very complex decision that we had to make. Everybody was asked to decide on something. And the ideas come in, influences come in from all different directions. You can see up there, it's imposing again and again and again. Should we be looking at the NHS? Should we be looking at immigration? Should we be worried about taxes? Should we be worried about trade? Should we be worried about all the things that matter? How are we going to run the country? How are we going to break away? How will we have food coming in? Will we get out-of-season tomatoes? Will we get toilet rolls going to be rationed? How is the healthcare going to work? Will there be fewer people living here? Will there be more nurses? Will there be less nurses in the staff? What's going to go on? How much is it going to cost? And out of that, we were all expected to come up and make a decision, and it is incredibly hard to do that. So what the human brain does, it goes from an emotional decision. I think this, and I'm going to vote whichever way I'm going to vote because I think this. And having made that decision, the whole concept of eisegesis comes in. I take what I think, and when I look at something else, that shapes how I understand it. I'm going to interpret what I read in the way that supports my own presuppositions or agenda or bias. Having made a decision and voted, I'm going to read the paper, and I'm going to read a newspaper that I like, that supports what I think, that adds evidence to what I believe, that says what I think. And I'm going to struggle to look at a different image. I'm going to read stuff on the computers. I'm going to hear the news. I'm going to listen to things. I'm going to feel people's opinions. And what was interesting, how do we know we've done that? How do we know that's the behaviour? Because the gut instinct is to say, no, I looked at the evidence and I thought about things and it matters to me. When somebody pops up the image of that big red bus, if your reaction to it is, interesting point, don't quite agree with it, or if your reaction is, wrong, no, how could they put that number out? Or if your reaction is, yeah, someone's telling the truth, speak it like it is. That emotional response is what will happen if the initial decision was not based on evidence but based on an emotional reaction in the first place. The emotion lives inside you. You make the decision, I think I've got energy coming up. Come on, is it going to work? Nope. Right. I try to find an image of a fist holding tight. And it just looks like someone's going to punch you out of the screen. What it is it matters to you so much. It becomes part of you. It becomes that when somebody challenges that decision, they're confronting me. That when somebody is expressing a view that I don't agree with, I take it personally. And I'll respond as if it was a personal confrontation. I can't hear the evidence. The eisegesis comes in. I put my ideas onto the evidence, and the result being, I'm not willing to look at the evidence that might suggest I made the wrong decision. Because that's wrong, and I don't want to have to change my mind. I don't want someone to confront me. I don't want someone to challenge me, because it hurts for me to change my whole approach and to say, do you know what, maybe I'm wrong about this. There was something on the news in the last week or two in America. One of Donald Trump's advising lawyers, he's worked with Donald Trump for about 10 years, and he sat in front of a House from the Senate Representatives Committee, and he apologized. He said, the things that I had done previously, I was wrong about. The things I said, the things I was involved with were wrong. Now, I don't know whether I like this person very much or not. What he did was incredibly... Anyway... But the strength it had to take to say I was wrong in those situations. The decision he had, how far down did he have to go before he realised this is so bad, I've now got to undo all as best I can all the things and try and make amends for it. Especially when the picture of the big red bus appears up there and there's a, or there's a whatever feeling, there's a reaction to it, and that reaction matters. We've looked at this character who was blessed by the people, by his followers, by the prophets, by the law, and by God. And Jesus said, love your neighbour as yourself. Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. Pray for those who didn't vote the same way that you did. Love those people who expressed the opposite opinion to your feeling about the big red bus. Feel the response over the next week. When there's a news report, when there's an article, when there's an expert or whoever with an opinion on the telly or on the radio who's expressing their feelings either for or against, how does that make me feel? Am I responding with anger against someone who is just putting out figures and facts that I need to be aware of? Am I responding badly? Maybe they've got a point. Maybe I should listen. Maybe I should learn something. Maybe things should move on. Even if they're wrong. Even if they are spouting the biggest bunch of jargon you have ever heard and it's just words. And you know, fine well, that somebody is somewhere has got an agenda that is the background and you don't know what's going on. And this person is just offensive. They are still loved by the true and living God. Just some little homework for the next week. Something to take away. Something to remember it by. And we come back to the idea of the blessing of the people and the followers and everybody else that comes up, that falls upon Jesus' head. And we're echoing that in the next hymn, which is, Jesus is Lord. Creation's voice proclaims it.